Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
In the early 1980s, a new American television series called Hill Street Blues hit Irish TV screens. It was a police drama unlike anything we'd seen before. Set in the fictional precinct of Hill Street, in a gritty, deprived part of an unnamed American city, Chicago, Pittsburgh, New York, the station's chaos was conveyed by documentary-style filming, often with handheld cameras. That was new. The nature of friendship was a strong theme in the show, as were questions of right and wrong. There were storylines around infidelity and topical issues like AIDS and drugs. Not every storyline would be resolved at the end of one episode. Some would carry on into the next one, and the next. That, too, was new. At the series' heart was the large cast of brilliant characters whose personal and professional struggles were played out with delicacy and nuance. I had three favourites. Undercover cop Belker, who looked dodgier than any gang member and literally barked and growled like a dog at suspects. Debonair divorced Staff Sergeant Phil Esterhaus, whose amorous exploits were legion. He began each episode with a roll call of Hill Street's cops and an outline of what might come up that day, before warning his crew, and hey, let's be careful out there, before the opening credits rolled. And the man in charge of them all, Captain Frank Farrillo, always impeccably dressed in a three-piece suit. Farrillo, played by Daniel J. Tavanti, held the station together, supporting his cops, but reining them in when they went too far. He negotiated truces between the gangs and struggled with the city's bureaucracy and politics. His private life was equally challenging. He had an ever-demanding ex-wife and a new relationship with defence attorney Joyce Davenport, whose job was to defend the very people Farrillo was trying to convict. Episodes frequently ended with these two in bed or in the bath, talking about the day's events. Hill Street was groundbreaking and widely regarded as paving the way for shows like The Sopranos, The West Wing, Mad Men and Breaking Bad. It was compelling, and for the teenager that I was, unmissable. Sometimes I'd watch it with my mother, who'd grown up on the shores of Lake Michigan between Chicago and Milwaukee. And when I did, she'd always remark that she knew the actor who played Captain Farrillo, Daniel J. Tavanti. They'd both gone to Mary D. Bradford High School in her hometown of Kenosha, she said. Daniel had had a part-time job delivering fruit and vegetables to their house, she told me one night. She sometimes rewrote Daniel's English essays for him, as her handwriting was better than his, she boasted. And once, she casually mentioned, Daniel had even stolen a kiss from her. I was highly sceptical about all this, bearing in mind my mother's firmly held belief in the existence of angels and conspiracy theories that could fill volumes. And as in those pre-internet days the Tavanti connection was impossible to either prove or refute, it was left as unresolved as a storyline at the end of a Hill Street episode. When, a few years later, Tavanti appeared on Terry Wogan's chat show on the BBC, I listened to my mother phone London and leave a message for him. If he was coming to Dublin, she'd love to see him. Now, surely I'd find out if there was any substance behind these stories. But the reply that eventually came from the Beeb neither confirmed nor denied any acquaintance. Mr. Tavanti didn't have time to go to Dublin. Maybe next time. However, over a decade later, the story was finally resolved when my mother returned to America for the first time in many years. In the meantime, she had written to Tavanti, and on this trip, she didn't just meet up with him. She was invited to stay at his house. She returned, quietly triumphant, with a photograph of him on which he had written, "Dear Mary, you were my June Allison, Daniel J. Tavanti." My mother was his June Allison, the 1950s American movie star known for playing the girl next door, similar to Doris Day. I admitted defeat, but was sincerely impressed. But that wasn't all. The following year, in 2003, came the final episode of this story when Tavanti came to Ireland for a holiday and to see my mother. And during this visit, Captain Farrillo of Hill Street Blues visited me, my wife and two small children. I will never forget the sight of a grey-haired Captain Farrillo sitting in our tiny living room. Initially, conversation was stilted. I mean, what do you say to Captain Farrillo? After chatting for a while, we went for a walk to Joyce's Tower. I asked him about Hill Street and then about his and my family. Trevanti confirmed most of my mother's recollections, as well as adding extra details about the connection between our families, particularly regarding my grandfather, John McAvoy. My grandfather was a Kenosha lawyer who'd handled the Trevanti family's immigration from Italy to America and remained the family lawyer for many years. According to the person who was then transforming from Captain Farrillo to Dan, his father said that if he ever had any problem, Mr. McAvoy would sort it. But the funny thing was, Dan was taking as much interest in me as I was in him. He seemed to take genuine pleasure in meeting the son of his childhood friend, if not sweetheart, and asked about my writing, my work, and my family as we walked. And as we neared Sandy Cove, I watched a car drive towards us, and the driver literally do a double take, mouth falling wide open, head turning as he passed, staring at the person walking beside me. It was as if he couldn't believe what his eyes were telling him. There was Daniel J. Trevanti. There was Captain Farrillo. And though I was walking along with him, I hardly believed it myself. But it was true. And in these strange times we find ourselves in, when everything seems to take on new meaning, it's been a pleasure to re-watch old Hill Street episodes, currently available on the Channel 4 player, and to remember Sergeant Esterhaus's wise note of caution. And hey, let's be careful out there.
I'm Bradley Progress, this is your bus door, corner of People's Drive and 124th Street.
Trying to order less online and to buy Irish when I do. I'm sure you are too. But every so often I weaken. A packet arrived recently from Liberty in London. The three soft cotton squares inside with William Morris prints and hand-rolled hems are the loveliest things I've bought myself in ages. I'm in the grip of a new obsession. Handkerchiefs. It has crept up on me in the last few years. The only acceptable form of hanky-panky for a woman of my age, you might say, although I find that thought depressing. I suppose there must have been boxes of tissues around the house when I was growing up. Kimberly Clark launched Kleenex, designed to remove cold cream, in 1924. I'm not that old. By the early 1930s, they were selling millions as disposable nose wipes under the slogan, "Don't carry a cold around in your pocket." Clever, but mendacious, given that most of us carry soggy, germ-infested paper balls around when we have no spares. Or we did, until COVID-19 made us more careful. I don't remember what we used as children, but I do remember my mother saying, "I like a real handkerchief." Luckily for her, my father had grown up in the linen triangle. Sometimes on Sundays we would visit his aunt and uncle in Donaghcloney, a county down village dominated by Lidl's, once the biggest linen mill in Ireland and the place where Aunt Jane and Uncle Willie worked. These visits followed a set routine. In between the tea and the farewells, Uncle Willie would say to my mother, "Dorothy, come up to the bedroom with me. I could give you a hanky or two." Although Dad and Aunt Jane seemed unperturbed by this dubious invitation, my sister and I trooped up the stairs on sentry duty. Seconds, handkerchiefs with small flaws, which Lidl's workers could have for half nothing, were fished from a bottom drawer. Even as a small child, I thought it odd to see Uncle Willie, a former merchant seaman with big, brawny forearms covered in violent-looking tattoos, handing over hankies made of the most delicate linen lawn. Mum thanked him politely, but you could tell that she was slightly disappointed. Uncle Willie's handkerchiefs were absolutely plain. She favoured subtle decoration and might hint to us that she'd appreciate one with a little bit of white embroidery as a Mother's Day present. What a pathetic request, I used to think, especially in my truculent teenage years. Why didn't she ask for some decent makeup? Mary Quant had pioneered a purple gel eyeshadow that I wouldn't have minded borrowing. Then I'd remember Mum had once had her face done up in a department store and was so unnerved by her appearance. I thought Hollywood, she thought harlot, that the only cosmetics she would countenance were lipsticks. Only recently have I begun to think more positive thoughts about hankies. Like men's ties, which are also making a comeback, they reveal something about their owner's personality, flamboyant or understated. They're elegant too, so much more elegant than a paper tissue, even if it has been expensively infused with aloe vera. And because they're more robust, they effectively perform more functions, scrubbing every lick of chocolate from a child's face, mopping up incessant tears, or, when large enough and appropriately knotted, keeping the sun off a scorched neck or bald spot. I don't imagine we'll ever get back to the complex messaging system that handkerchiefs performed in the 1800s. Kept stuffed down the bosom, they were handy flirtation aids at a time when women were mostly too demure to speak out. Touching your hanky to your left cheek meant no, and to your right cheek, yes. Holding it over your shoulder meant follow me. Twisting it in your left hand meant I want to be rid of you. And so on. The potential for error was perilous. But they can still give signals. When my mother was old and bedridden in a nursing home, she took to spreading a large handkerchief over her face when she wanted to rest. It softened the light, she said, but really it was her do not disturb sign. Glimpsing it, visitors would retreat exactly as she intended. I've inherited some of her handkerchiefs, but I need more now that disposable tissues made from trees and enormous amounts of water are among the single-use things we should stop buying for the sake of our waste-choked, carbon-compromised planet. Linen ones will last forever, which is just as well because they're pricey. I'm not telling you how much I paid the other day for 5, ordered from a Chelsea-based company owned by the old northern firm of Samuel Lamont. It doesn't really matter. I know I'm going to love them. They have a small bit of white embroidery in one corner.
In 3 days' time, on Wednesday, March the 25th, the winners of this year's Golden Fleece Award will be announced. Google Golden Fleece Award, and chances are what will pop up first, even before Jason or the Argonauts, will be the description from Wikipedia of a tongue-in-cheek award given to public officials in the United States for their squandering of public money. Not a bad enterprise to be associated with, but a far cry from the award that my late aunt, Lilias Mitchell, set up. Lilias's Golden Fleece is an annual art prize. This year is its 19th. Unusual, if not unique, because it's a hybrid, open to both visual artists of all disciplines and to craftspeople. With this one, nobody gets fleeced. On the contrary, the prize money, €30,000 this year, is a reward not just for excellence. Applicants, as well as presenting their best recent work, must be able to make a case for financial need, outlining how winning the main award, or one of the smaller merit awards, could be a game changer for their practice. Lilias was a painter, a sculptor, a spinner and weaver, an authority on vegetable dyes, and a teacher. She was 85 at the time of her death 20 years ago, having spent the last years of her life devising, revising, and fine-tuning the award. Like a piece of sculpture, she endlessly honed the legal document that would define her dream, as if she knew it would be her most lasting legacy to the world of Irish art and crafts. Lilias was not born into the art world. Her father was a businessman, an austerely upright Presbyterian. Though none in fine art, there was, however, strong family background in the crafts. My paternal great-grandfather had come over from Scotland to establish a poplin weaving factory in the Liberties in the 1840s. There were bookbinders and cabinet makers on the Scottish side of the family too. But it was really thanks to my grandmother's initiative that the seeds of Lilias's career as an artist and a teacher of craft were sown. Having given birth to two sons, when my grandmother's first and only girl child came along, it was as though she saw her chance to pour her own frustrated creative energy into her daughter. She set up 11-year-old Lilias's first serious art class, Saturday mornings with a small group of children learning brushwork with Elizabeth Lolly Yates in Rathgar. Lilias later studied painting at the Royal Hibernian Academy School and sculpture at the National College of Art. In 1943, by now in her late 20s, she travelled to Wales to take up a job at Howells School, a girls' boarding school where she had briefly been a pupil as a teenager. She'd been hired to teach bookbinding and clay modelling. She only stayed a couple of years, but it was here, thanks to an exceptional teacher of weaving already on the staff, that she developed her passion for all aspects of working with wool, sorting fleeces, carding, spinning, making vegetable dyes, dyeing the wool, and finally, weaving. And here's where the Golden Fleece comes back in. Returning to Dublin with messianic zeal, Lilias looked around for ways of passing on her new skills. In 1946, having persuaded a Welsh friend and fellow weaver to join her, she established a workshop in a former vegetable shop on Lower Mount Street, two ground floor rooms in a building owned by her father. With a couple of borrowed looms, they set to, making work and also offering classes. Soon they were receiving commissions and exhibiting. The Irish Times published a lengthy feature on their work. A painted wooden shingle went up on the street. It read Golden Fleece and showed a weaver's shuttle. By 1949, the school was thriving and Lilias was offering courses at elementary and intermediate level. But it was not viable, and when Lilias's co-worker was offered a teaching post in England, she took it. Alone, Lilias could not continue. However, the fame of the Golden Fleece workshop had spread. It reached the desk of General Mulcahy, then Minister for Education. Lilias was summoned to meet him. The teaching of the arts in Ireland was under scrutiny at the time and found lacking. Lilias's timing could not have been better. In 1951, Mulcahy, of whom Lilias always spoke with huge warmth and gratitude, charged her with setting up a department of spinning, weaving and dyeing in the National College of Art, which she did, teaching there very happily and, by all accounts, inspiringly, until her retirement in 1980. And now for the gold. Lilias did not marry, and her father, never imagining that she might one day hold down a pensionable job, had, as the phrase goes, provided for her. But his efforts were not needed. Lilias's lifestyle was frugal, her pension adequate, which is why, after retirement, she began to dream, and then to take steps to make sure her dream would come true, pouring all her accumulated wealth into the creation of her very own Golden Fleece Award. And only 3 days to go until we discover who this year's winners are.
Mellow, the moonlight to shine is beginning. Close by the window, young island is spinning. Bent o'er the fire, her blind grandmother.
She read as she cradled. You part of me, every day your history, every tomorrow your destiny, every growth your mystery, every mother wants a baby like you. Every laugh your personality, every look your clarity, every word your stability, every mother wants a baby like you. Every hiccup a comedy, every fall a catastrophe, every worry my worry, every step you're beside me, every sight your pure beauty, every mother wants a baby like you. Every tear wiped carefully, every word spoke lovingly, every meal fed silently, every cloth washed caringly, every song sung sweetly, every day I whisper quietly, every mother wants a baby like you.
My enthusiasm for borrowing books from libraries, friends, or loved ones is only deepened by my cheerful disregard for returning them. The house I grew up in was stacked with poetry and fiction, but I was aware from the beginning of my role as a part-time steward of my mother's book collection. Anytime I asked, "Can I have this?" came the reply, "You can borrow it." One Sunday morning, not long ago, I was on a flight to Dublin. On my lap was a borrowed copy of Richard Ellman's biography of Oscar Wilde, a breeze block of a thing in which he contrives to have very little to say about Wilde's wife Constance. But I was writing a novel called The Mystery of Love, which tells her story. It was no day for work, but on the plane I began the job I had been putting off for weeks, and this was to write the scene in which Constance plans to visit Oscar in prison. I had been putting off writing it because it was turning into a scene about something else entirely. The morning I was about to spend with my mother was going to be our last. She had been living for a long time with cancer, which hadn't yet had its way, but was about to. All the better that she was asleep when I arrived. Now, this is the big moment where the author is supposed to give the unflinching account of his dying mother's frailty. Isn't that what we're supposed to do? Cast the cold eye? And her skin, parchment-like and see-through, her frame as insubstantial as a quail's. But I can't go any further than that. I won't. If Constance was in denial about Oscar, I was in denial about my mother's illness, where she was and where all this was going. Grief, or the anticipation of it, absolves you of all reason. And lately, whenever I hadn't been able to sleep, and wherever I was, on my travels or at home in Glasgow, I'd been returning to her room with its scalloped white pillowcases, and my mother asleep in the single bed with a view of Scotland's Bay. In my mind, she was growing more comfortable as time passed. And I know as well as anyone that this wasn't the case. My mother was a very curious woman. In all probability, it had been years since she had had a thought untroubled by death. Her room was north-facing, but you could count on a meter of sun at this time of the morning, and I was happy that she awoke to light on her face. Some people become children when they're bedbound, and I don't mean behaving poorly, rather they reveal themselves. And she was occupying this stripe of sunlight with her chin raised. The interlude was all hers. This was the kind of woman who took good weather personally. In the pile of books by her bed was an old Penguin paperback of Edna O'Brien's Country Girls, and there was Mum's signature on the top right hand of the title page. The signature said, "This isn't yours to keep," but I was grateful for the loan of it anyway, along with everything else I borrowed. Mum intercepted my gaze as I packed the book into my bag. Instead of reproaching me about borrowing things I had no intention of returning, she was smiling, and the smile said we were on a new footing. "You'll be back soon," she said. And these were, more or less, the last words we spoke to each other. Far too straightforward from which to build a eulogy, but lucid and generous and slightly evading the point, which is, romantic love is beautiful and spectral. Those foolish ghosts can live forever, but the love of a mother belongs to the body, and when it goes, it's gone. I walked in slanting rain to the airport bus. Birds skittered in the wind. And on the plane, for Constance, I wrote the words, when she goes in the end, the breath of love may go with her, or it may not. It may live on without her knowing it. And all of this amounted to the prison scene being a scene of goodbye, much like the one we had just gone through. My mother would not object to me saying that she read her way into peace in life and onwards towards the next one. 1 week after my visit, she died. Let's say that to go on a Sunday was part of an ongoing conversation with God, or a demonstration of her faith that I was too unimaginative to share, and that she was happy to have to herself. But when I closed the door in her room that morning, our relationship ended. It doesn't live on, and I try not to think of her. To remember my mother is to acknowledge that she's no longer there.
Today is Mother's Day, but it has a strange feel to it. No children, no grandchildren around my table. Maybe a few faces and voices on Skype later on today, some from only a couple of miles down the road. For the same reason, I'm talking to you from home, using my phone to record this. Mothers, by our very nature, worry. We call to our children, "Don't cycle too fast. Don't jump off the pier at low tide. Don't stay out too late." Usually our rosaries of don'ts are scattered in the hedgerows, and we realise we have to trust our young ones so they can trust themselves. Now it's they, as adults, who have to worry about their mother, their dad, their grandma. This week, I listened as my daughter advised me not to let the grandchildren visit us, and with the news that's coming day by day, we certainly aren't taking any chances. So instead, we spent a sunny afternoon in a local park, appropriately social distancing, watching our three-year-old grandson from afar cycle laps of the pond and the flower bed. He was so proud to show off his newly acquired skills, and we were enthralled with his good humour and childishness. I even managed to resist the mammy cry, "Don't go too fast." Mothers have weathered other crises before COVID-19. In the month after my twin boys were born, exactly 34 years ago, the Chernobyl disaster unleashed not only radioactive contamination, but a wave of anxiety across the world. Would my milk be contaminated, I worried. "Sorry for bringing you into a world like this," I whispered. But they just looked at me with their wide blue eyes, knowing nothing other than to trust their parents. On September the 11th, 2001, my sister rang me from New York. "I'm okay," she said. "I'm walking home from work. It'll take a couple of hours. There's smoke and fragments of paper everywhere. But I'm worried about my boys. Those boys, in their 20s, are looking out for her now. Every day this week, we've gone for a drive and a walk well away from other people with a flask of coffee. Brayhead, or Killiney Hill, Ardgillan Domain, or Skerries Beach. I've discovered things that previously I'd ignored. Like nearby, the red brick chimney, which stands beside the Milltown Viaduct, on which the Lewis Green Line runs above the Dodder River. It once was a working chimney for a laundry. I remember a black and red van collecting and delivering linen in our estate in the 1950s. It didn't strike me as strange then that it was called Swastika Laundry, as I was unaware of the use of that symbol by the Nazis. It seems that the laundry was founded in 1912 and took the cross-type logo from its ancient origins as a symbol of prosperity. Little did I know until this week that the Shanagarry chimney in Milltown was used by Old Dublin Laundry until the 1960s. After that, it was maintained as a protected structure. But more amazing is the fact that it was sold in 2018 as a lucrative property, housing a mobile service communications mast. My local chimney fetched €136,000 at auction 2 years ago. Our days at the moment have quite a pleasant Victorian feel. Reading, walking, taking tea at home. In Bray we felt particularly Victorian, as this was a small manorial village until the latter part of the 18th century, when the Dublin middle classes began to move to Bray. The Dublin and Kingston Railway, the first in Ireland, opened in 1834 and was extended as far as Bray in 1854. With the railway came tourists, and the town grew as a seaside resort. On our walk along the promenade, it was lovely to admire the residential terraces and the Esplanade Hotel on the seafront. My paternal grandparents brought their family to Bray from the Midlands in the 1930s for summer holidays. By the mid-20th century, Bray's popularity as a resort had declined when foreign travel became an option for holidaymakers. Look out, Bray, your heyday is about to return. We may be heading for a period of using our own resources, our initiative, our imagination. We have plenty of it, and it doesn't have to be bought in shops. We mothers may be worriers, but we're also the mothers of invention and the soothers of pain. I don't feel a great need for flowers and chocolates on Mother's Day. But I've often said, just raise a glass to mothers, mothers-in-law, godmothers, grandmothers. Today, we can do just that.
On this morning's programme, we heard My Mother and Daniel J. Trevanti by Tim Carey. Imagine if it was by Jim Carey, my goodness. Hanky Swanky by Mary Dewey. Then The Golden Fleece by Geraldine Mitchell. After that, She Read As She Cradled, a poem by Len Cisse. Then You Can Borrow It by Andrew Meehan. And finally, A Different Kind of Mother's Day by Nulla Groen. This morning's music began with the unmistakable theme from Hill Street Blues, composed by Mike Post. Then we heard The Star of the County Down by Van Morrison and the Chieftains. The Spinning Wheel, a ballad by John Francis Waller, made famous by Delia Murphy, but this morning's version was sung by Nana Mouskouri. After that, we heard Shabaw Milanov, Shush My Baby by Katrina O'Leary and Thulra. And finally, Schubert's Serenade, played by Julian Lloyd Webber on cello and John Lenihan on piano. And Lem Sisse's reading was recorded at the recent Sunday Miscellany Live at Ennis Book Club Festival, and you can enjoy more from that event next week. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Carolyn Dempsey. The producer is Sarah Binchy.
RTE Radio 1.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.